The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timson. Barnaby Rudge. Barnaby Rudge was the second novel to appear in Dickens's experimental magazine, Master Humphrey's Clock, which he launched in 1840. The public had not taken to the idea of this random collection of short stories and articles, and Dickens was forced to work hard to save his magazine. He had serialized the old Curiosity Shop and now followed its success with Barnaby Rudge. Barnaby Rudge was, like the magazine in which it first appeared, an innovation for Dickens. He was a popular author, but Dickens knew that to be taken seriously as a writer of fiction, he must have a success with an historical novel. Sir Walter Scott had set the precedent in the early years of the 19th century. Dickens only attempted to write outside his own age twice, with Barnaby Rudge and A Tale of Two Cities. It was his reading of the historian Thomas Carlyle's dramatic retelling of the French Revolution that inspired Dickens to try his own hand at recreating the notorious Gordon Riots that took place in London in 1780. The Gordon Riots were induced by the MP Lord George Gordon in response to changes in the laws against Roman Catholics. Since the Reformation, the activities of Catholics had been severely restricted, coupled with heavy taxation and denial of education at the universities. In 1778, a small concession was made to them in the Catholic Relief Act, relaxing some restrictions. This was enough, however, to fuel Protestant indignation amongst the public, exacerbated by Gordon's blatantly anti-Catholic speeches. The rejection by Parliament of a petition containing 100,000 signatures was the flashpoint for the mob violence that followed. Gordon is presented by Dickens as a weak man in the hands of an unscrupulous secretary, Gashford, who is fictitious. Dickens's method of recreating history is to offer a sequence of picturesque 18th century scenes that would have graced the wall of any 19th century parlour. Dickens creates the image of the smoothly effete 18th century gentleman, Sir John Chester, for instance, with his snuff-box and finely cut wine-glass in hand, his air of condescension thinly disguising his cruel nature. And, by contrast, the rustic picture of a country inn and its eccentric collection of bucolic locals who gather, tankards in hand, round the ever-present roaring fire for a gossip or a gripe. Yet far from romanticising the past, Dickens wished to show it as it appeared to his 19th-century eyes. A society secure, snug and smug on the surface, yet full of cruelty and injustice. An uncivilised time. In focusing on the Gordon Riots, Dickens wanted to show his public the dangers of irresponsible free speech that could whip up a bigoted mob and threaten the security of a nation. We must all guard against complacency, Dickens is saying, but it is the responsibility of the government to be perpetually alert. It should be remembered that Dickens was writing at another time of social unrest, the 1840s. The Chartists, a movement wanting radical reform, were seen as a threat to peace and security in much the same way as the Gordon mob of 1780. There had been minor skirmishes involving Chartists in Birmingham and Newport at the time Dickens was writing this novel, and these radical changes to the political structure of England gave a sharp immediacy to his historical novel. Dickens always felt that mankind was holding on to civilization by its fingertips, whilst the dark abyss of ignorance yawned beneath. The seemingly cosy and complacent scenes in the Maypole Inn are shown to breed petty tyranny in the landlord, John Willett, towards his son Joe, whilst the secure domestic environment of Gabriel Varden's house shelters Sim Tappertit, the prentice, whose vanity leads him to create a secret society called the United Bulldogs that promotes anti-Catholic prejudice and plays an active part in the riots. Both the Maypole and Varden's house fall victim to the mob. Safety and security are delusions to Dickens. Amongst the innocent victims sucked into the mob is the novel's eponymous hero, Barnaby. A simpleton, the holy fool of romantic literature, who is the innocent butt of the unfeeling world about him. His pet raven, Grip, seems to have more of a grip on worldly matters than his master, the bird's random quotations and demeanour making him seem at times grotesquely human. Dickens himself had a pet raven, and was fascinated by its mimicry. It cannot be said that Barnaby Rudge was a great success. The magazine's circulation fell, and with the publication of the final chapters, Dickens announced the closure of Master Humphrey's Clock. The novel has never been one of Dickens's most popular. Perhaps the uneasy balance of plot and historical fact accounts for this. But Dickens remained undaunted by the novel's poor reception. He wrote with inimitable confidence, "I was always sure I could make a good thing of Barnaby, and I think you'll find that it comes out strong to the last word." A description of Barnaby.
"What's he here to do?" said the old man, alighting. "How's this? What, Barnaby?"
The bearer of the torch shook his long, loose hair back from his eyes, and thrusting his face eagerly into that of the locksmith, fixed upon him a look which told his history at once.
"You know me, Barnaby?" said Varden.
He nodded, not once or twice, but a score of times, and that with a fantastic exaggeration which would have kept his head in motion for an hour, but that the locksmith held up his finger, and fixing his eyes sternly upon him, caused him to desist. Then pointed to the body with an inquiring look.
"There's blood upon him," said Barnaby with a shudder. "It makes me sick."
"How came it there?" demanded Varden.
"Steel, steel, steel,"
he replied fiercely, imitating with his hand the thrust of a sword.
"Is he robbed?" said the locksmith.
Barnaby caught him by the arm and nodded, "Yes," then pointed towards the city.
"Oh," said the old man, bending over the body and looking round as he spoke into Barnaby's pale face, strangely lighted up by something that was not intellect.
"The robber made off that way, did he? Well, well, never mind that just now. Hold your torch this way, a little farther off. So, now stand quiet while I try to see what harm is done."
With these words he applied himself to a closer examination of the prostrate form, while Barnaby, holding the torch as he had been directed, looked on in silence, fascinated by interest or curiosity, but repelled nevertheless by some strong and secret horror which convulsed him in every nerve. As he stood, at that moment, half shrinking back and half bending forward, both his face and figure were full in the strong glare of the link, and as distinctly revealed as though it had been broad day. He was about 23 years old, and though rather spare, of a fair height and strong make. His hair, of which he had a great profusion, was red, and hanging in disorder about his face and shoulders, gave to his restless looks an expression quite unearthly, enhanced by the paleness of his complexion and the glassy lustre of his large, protruding eyes. Startling as his aspect was, the features were good, and there was something even plaintive in his wan and haggard aspect. But the absence of the soul is far more terrible in a living man than in a dead one, and in this unfortunate being its noblest powers were wanting. His dress was of green, clumsily trimmed here and there, apparently by his own hands, with gaudy lace, brightest where the cloth was most worn and soiled, and poorest where it was at the best. A pair of tawdry ruffles dangled at his wrists, while his throat was nearly bare. He had ornamented his hat with a cluster of peacock's feathers, but they were limp and broken, and now trailed negligently down his back. Girt to his side was the steel hilt of an old sword, without blade or scabbard, and some party-coloured ends of ribbons and poured-glass toys completed the ornamental portion of his attire. The fluttered and confused disposition of all the motley scraps that formed his dress bespoke, in a scarcely less degree than his eager and unsettled manner, the disorder of his mind, and by a grotesque contrast set off and heightened the more impressive wildness of his face.
"Barnaby," said the locksmith, after a hasty but careful inspection, "this man is not dead, but he has a wound in his side and is in a fainting fit."
"I know him, I know him,"
cried Barnaby, clapping his hands.
"Know him?" repeated the locksmith.
"Hush!"
said Barnaby, laying his fingers upon his lips.
"He went out today a-wooing. I wouldn't for a light guinea that he should never go a-wooing again, for if he did, some eyes would grow dim that are now as bright as... See, when I talk of eyes, the stars come out! whose eyes are they? If they are angels' eyes, why do they look down here and see good men hurt and only wink and sparkle all the night?
Now, heaven help this silly fellow, murmured the perplexed locksmith. Can he know this gentleman? His mother's house is not far off. I'd better see if she can tell me who he is. Barnaby, my man, help me to put him in the chaise, and we'll ride home together.
I can't touch him,
cried the idiot, falling back and shuddering as with a strong spasm.
He's bloody!
It's in his nature, I know, muttered the locksmith. It's cruel to ask him, but I must have help. Barnaby, good Barnaby, dear Barnaby, if you know this gentleman for the sake of his life and everybody's life that loves him, help me to raise him and lay him down.
Cover him, then. Wrap him close. Don't let me see it. Smell it. Hear the word. Don't speak the word. Don't.
No, no, I'll not. Yeah, you see, he's covered now. Gently. Well done. Well done.
They placed him in the carriage with great ease, for Barnaby was strong and active, but all the time they were so occupied he shivered from head to foot and evidently experienced an ecstasy of terror.
Simon Tappertit and Mr. Varden.
"Here's enough of that just now," said the locksmith. "You needn't make any more of that confounded clatter. Breakfast's ready."
"Sir," said Sim, looking up with amazing politeness and a peculiar little bow cut short off at the neck. "I shall attend you immediately."
"I suppose," muttered Gabriel, "that's out of the Prentice's Garland, or the Prentice's Delight, or the Prentice's Warbler, or the Prentice's Guide to the Gallows, or some such improving textbook. Now he's going to beautify himself. He is a precious locksmith."
Quite unconscious that his master was looking on from the dark corner by the parlour door, Sim threw off the paper cap, sprang from his seat, and in two extraordinary steps, something between skating and minuet dancing, bounded to a washing place at the other end of the shop, and there removed from his face and hands all traces of his previous work, practising the same step all the time with the utmost gravity. This done, he drew from some concealed place a little scrap of looking-glass, and with its assistance arranged his hair and ascertained the exact state of a little carbuncle on his nose. Having now completed his toilet, he placed the fragment of mirror on a low bench and looked over his shoulder at so much of his legs as could be reflected in that small compass with the greatest possible complacency and satisfaction. Sim, as he was called in the locksmith's family, or Mr. Simon Tappertit, as he called himself, and required all men to style him out of doors on holidays and Sundays out, was an old-fashioned, thin-faced, sleek-haired, sharp-nosed, small-eyed little fellow, very little more than 5 feet high, and thoroughly convinced in his own mind that he was above the middle size. Rather tall, in fact, than otherwise. Of his figure, which was well enough formed, though somewhat of the leanest, he entertained the highest admiration. And with his legs, which in knee-breeches were perfect curiosities of littleness, he was enraptured to a degree amounting to enthusiasm. He also had some majestic, shadowy ideas, which had never been quite fathomed by his intimate friends, concerning the power of his eye. Indeed, he had been known to go so far as to boast that he could utterly quell and subdue the haughtiest beauty by a simple process, which he termed eyeing her over. But it must be added that neither of this faculty nor of the power he claimed to have through the same gift of vanquishing and heaving down dumb animals, even in a rabid state, had he ever furnished evidence which could be deemed quite satisfactory and conclusive. It may be inferred from these premises that in the small body of Mr. Tappertit there was locked up an ambitious and aspiring soul. As certain liquors, confined in casks too cramped in their dimensions, will ferment and fret and chafe in their imprisonment, so the spiritual essence or soul of Mr. Tappertit would sometimes fume within that precious cask, his body, until with great foam and froth and splutter it would force a vent and carry all before it. It was his custom to remark, in reference to any one of these occasions, that his soul had got into his head, and in this novel kind of intoxication many scrapes and mishaps befell him, which he had frequently concealed with no small difficulty from his worthy master. Sim Tappertit, among the other fancies upon which his before-mentioned soul was for ever feasting and regaling itself, and which fancies, like the liver of Prometheus, grew as they were fed upon, had a mighty notion of his order, and had been heard by the servant-maid openly expressing his regret that the prentices no longer carried clubs wherewith to mace the citizens. That was his strong expression. He was likewise reported to have said that in former times a stigma had been cast upon the body by the execution of George Barnwell, to which they should not have basely submitted, but should have demanded him of the legislature, temperately at first, then by an appeal to arms if necessary, to be dealt with as they in their wisdom might think fit. These thoughts always led him to consider what a glorious engine the prentices might yet become if they had but a master spirit at their head, and then he would darkly, and to the terror of his hearers, hint at certain reckless fellows that he knew of, and at a certain lion-heart ready to become their captain, who, once afoot, would make the Lord Mayor tremble on his throne.
Miss Miggs lays a trap for Simon.
Miss Miggs, having undone her mistress, as she phrased it, which means assisted to undress her, and having seen her comfortably to bed in the back room on the first floor, withdrew to her own apartment in the attic story. Notwithstanding her declaration in the locksmith's presence, she was in no mood for sleep. So, putting her light upon the table and withdrawing the little window curtain, she gazed out pensively at the wild night sky. Perhaps she wondered what star was destined for her habitation when she had run her little course below. Perhaps speculated which of those glimmering spheres might be the natal orb of Mr. Tappertit. Perhaps marvelled how they could gaze down on that perfidious creature, man, and not sicken and turn green as chemists' lamps. Perhaps thought of nothing in particular. Whatever she thought about, there she sat, until her attention, alive to anything connected with the insinuating prentice, was attracted by a noise in the next room to her own. His room. The room in which he slept and dreamed. It might be, sometimes, dreamed of her. That he was not dreaming now, unless he was taking a walk in his sleep, was clear, for every now and then there came a shuffling noise, as though he were engaged in polishing the whitewashed wall, then a gentle creaking of his door, then the faintest indication of his stealthy footsteps on the landing place outside. Noting this latter circumstance, Miss Miggs turned pale and shuddered, as mistrusting his intentions, and more than once exclaimed, below her breath,
"Oh, what a providence it is, as I am bolted in!"
Which, owing doubtless to her alarm, was a confusion of ideas on her part between a bolt and its use, for though there was one on the door, it was not fastened. Miss Miggs's sense of hearing, however, having as sharp an edge as her temper, and being of the same snappish and suspicious kind, very soon informed her that the footsteps passed her door, and appeared to have some object quite separate and disconnected from herself. At this discovery she became more alarmed than ever, and was about to give utterance to those cries of "thieves" and "murder" which she had hitherto restrained, when it occurred to her to look softly out and see that her fears had some good palpable foundation. Looking out accordingly, and stretching her neck over the handrail, she descried, to her great amazement, Mr. Tappertit, completely dressed, stealing downstairs one step at a time, with his shoes in one hand and a lamp in the other. Following him with her eyes, and going down a little way herself to get the better of an intervening angle, she beheld him thrust his head in at the parlour door, draw it back again with great swiftness, and immediately begin a retreat upstairs with all possible expedition.
"Here's mysteries,"
said the damsel, when she was safe in her own room again, quite out of breath.
"Oh, gracious, here's mysteries."
The prospect of finding anybody out in anything would have kept Miss Miggs awake under the influence of henbane. Presently she heard the step again, as she would have done if it had been that of a feather endowed with motion and walking down on tiptoe. Then, gliding out as before, she again beheld the retreating figure of the prentice. Again he looked cautiously in at the parlour door, but this time, instead of retreating, he passed in and disappeared. Miggs was back in her room and had her head out of the window before an elderly gentleman could have winked and recovered from it. Out he came at the street door, shut it carefully behind him, tried it with his knee, and swaggered off, putting something in his pocket as he went along. At this spectacle, Miggs cried, "Gracious!" again, and then, "Goodness gracious!" and then, "Goodness gracious me!" and then, candle in hand, went downstairs as he had done. Coming to the workshop, she saw the lamp burning on the forge, and everything as Sim had left it.
"Why, I wish I might only have a walking funeral and never be buried decent with a mourning coach and feathers if the boy hasn't been and made a key for his own self!" cried Miggs. "Oh, the little villain!"
This conclusion was not arrived at without consideration and much peeping and peering about, nor was it unassisted by the recollection that she had on several occasions come upon the prentice suddenly and found him busy at some mysterious occupation. Lest the fact of Miss Miggs calling him, on whom she stooped to cast a favourable eye, a boy, should create surprise in any breast, it may be observed that she invariably affected to regard all male bipeds under 30 as mere chits and infants, which phenomenon is not unusual in ladies of Miss Miggs's temper, and is indeed generally found to be the associate of such indomitable and savage virtue. Miss Miggs deliberated within herself for some little time, looking hard at the shop door while she did so, as though her eyes and thoughts were both upon it, and then, taking a sheet of paper from a drawer, twisted it into a long, thin spiral tube. Having filled this instrument with a quantity of small coal dust from the forge, she approached the door, and dropping on one knee before it, dexterously blew into the keyhole as much of these fine ashes as the lock would hold. When she had filled it to the brim in a very workmanlike and skilful manner, she crept upstairs again and chuckled as she went.
"There!" cried Miggs, rubbing her hands. "Now let's see whether you won't be glad to take some notice of me, mister. You'll have eyes for somebody besides Miss Dolly now, I think. A fat-faced puss she is as ever I come across."
As she uttered this criticism, she glanced approvingly at her small mirror, as who should say, "I thank my stars, that can't be said of me," as it certainly could not, for Miss Miggs's style of beauty was of that kind which Mr. Tappertit himself had not inaptly termed in private, scraggy.
"Oh, don't go to bed this night,"
said Miggs, wrapping herself in a shawl and drawing a couple of chairs near the window, flouncing down upon one and putting her feet upon the other,
"till you come home, my lad." "I wouldn't," said Miggs viciously. "No, not for 45 pound.
With that, and with an expression of face in which a great number of opposite ingredients, such as mischief, cunning, malice, triumph, and patient expectation, were all mixed up together in a kind of physiognomical punch, Miss Miggs composed herself to wait and listen, like some fair ogress who had set a trap and was watching for a nibble from a plump young traveller.
The Attack on Newgate.
And now the strokes began to fall like hail upon the gate, and on the strong building, for those who could not reach the door spent their fierce rage on anything, even on the great blocks of stone which shivered their weapons into fragments and made their hands and arms to tingle as if the walls were active in their stout resistance and dealt them back their blows. The clash of iron, ringing upon iron, mingled with the deafening tumult and sounded high above it as the great sledge-hammers rattled on the nailed and plated door. The sparks flew off in showers. Men worked in gangs and at short intervals relieved each other, that all their strength might be devoted to the work. But there stood the portal still, as grim and dark and strong as ever, and, saving for the dints upon its battered surface, quite unchanged. While some brought all their energies to bear upon this toilsome task, and some, rearing ladders against the prison, tried to clamber to the summit of the walls they were too short to scale, and some again engaged a body of police 100 strong, and beat them back and trod them underfoot by force of numbers, others besieged the house on which the jailer had appeared, and driving in the door, brought out his furniture and piled it up against the prison gate to make a bonfire which should burn it down. As soon as this device was understood, all those who had laboured hitherto cast down their tools and helped to swell the heap. which reached halfway across the street and were so high that those who threw more fuel on the top got up by ladders. When all the keeper's goods were flung upon this costly pile, to the last fragment, they smeared it with the pitch and tar and rosin they had brought, and sprinkled it with turpentine. To all the woodwork round the prison doors they did the like, leaving not a joist or beam untouched. This infernal christening performed, they fired the pile with lighted matches and with blazing tow, and then stood by, awaiting the result. The furniture being very dry and rendered more combustible by wax and oil, besides the arts they had used, took fire at once. The flames roared high and fiercely, blackening the prison wall, and twining up its lofty front like burning serpents. At first they crowded round the blaze and vented their exultation only in their looks. But when it grew hotter and fiercer, when it crackled, leaped, and roared like a great furnace, when it shone upon the opposite houses and lighted up not only the pale and wondering faces at the windows, but the inmost corners of each habitation, when through the deep red heat and glow the fire was seen sporting and toying with the door, now clinging to its obdurate surface, now gliding off with fierce inconstancy and soaring high into the sky, anon returning to fold it in its burning grasp and lure it to its ruin, when it shone and gleamed so brightly that the church clock of St. Sepulchre's, so often pointing to the hour of death, was legible as in broad day, and the vane upon its steeple top glittered in the unwonted light like something richly jewelled, when blackened stone and sombre brick grew ruddy in the deep reflection, and windows shone like burnished gold, dotting the longest distance in the fiery vista with their specks of brightness, when wall and tower and roof and chimney stack seemed drunk and in the flickering glare appeared to reel and stagger, when scores of objects never seen before burst out upon the view and things the most familiar put on some new aspect, then the mob began to join the whirl, and with loud yells and shouts and clamour such as happily is seldom heard, bestirred themselves to feed the fire and keep it at its height. Although the heat was so intense that the paint on the houses over against the prison parched and crackled up and swelling into boils, as it were from excess of torture, broke and crumbled away, although the glass fell from the window sashes and the lead and iron on the roofs blistered the incautious hand that touched them, and the sparrows in the eaves took wing and, rendered giddy by the smoke, fell fluttering down upon the blazing pile, still the fire was tended unceasingly by busy hands, and round it men were going always. They never slackened in their zeal, or kept aloof, but pressed upon the flames so hard that those in front had much ado to save themselves from being thrust in. If one man swooned or dropped, a dozen struggled for his place, and that although they knew the pain and thirst and pressure to be unendurable. Those who fell down in fainting fits and were not crushed or burnt were carried to an inn-yard close at hand and dashed with water from a pump, of which buckets full were passed from man to man among the crowd. But such was the strong desire of all to drink, and such the fighting to be first, that for the most part the whole contents were spilled upon the ground, without the lips of one man being moistened. Meanwhile, and in the midst of all the roar and outcry, those who were nearest to the pile heaped up again the burning fragments that came toppling down and raked the fire about the door, which, although a sheet of flame, was still a door fast locked and barred, and kept them out. Great pieces of blazing wood were passed besides, above the people's heads, to such as stood about the ladders, and some of these, climbing up to the topmost stave and holding on with one hand by the prison wall, exerted all their skill and force to cast these firebrands on the roof or down into the yards within. In many instances their efforts were successful, which occasioned a new and appalling addition to the horrors of the scene. For the prisoners within, seeing from between their bars that the fire caught in many places and thrived fiercely, and being all locked up in strong cells for the night, began to know that they were in danger of being burnt alive. This terrible fear, spreading from cell to cell and from yard to yard, vented itself in such dismal cries and wailings, and in such dreadful shrieks for help, that the whole jail resounded with the noise, which was loudly heard even above the shouting of the mob and roaring of the flames, and was so full of agony and despair that it made the boldest tremble.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of Barnaby Rudge, read by Sean Barrett. for Naxos Audiobooks.